Welcome to episode 104 of Frank Reactions, the podcast where we help you profit from the digital era through better customer experiences online and off. My name is Tama Frank. My guest today is Jeff Toyster, who is the author of The Service Culture Handbook, a step-by-step guide to getting your employees obsessed with customer service. He's also been the author of some customer service training videos on lynda.com and was named one of the top 30 customer service professionals in the world by Global Gurus and one of the top 50 thought leaders to follow on Twitter, named so by the International Customer Management Institute. His new book is a very practical step-by-step guide to implementing customer service improvements, and I would say is an excellent companion piece to Gene Bliss's book, Chief Customer Officer 2.0. And I did do a podcast with Gene in episode 34 of Frank Reactions, so you can find that interview with Gene Bliss at frankreactions.com/34. In this episode with Jeff, you will find out the three elements of a good customer service vision statement, why you should not, according to Toyster, consult with customers when you're developing a customer service vision statement. That one kind of surprised me a bit. One question you should ask colleagues from all over your organization when you're developing that customer service vision statement, and what cultural artifacts are and how they affect your ability to improve customer experience. We'll get to that in a moment. Just before we do, quick heads up, I'm about to head off to Toronto, where I'll be speaking at the Marketing Research and Intelligence Association's annual conference about how to get buy-in for market research. And I also plan to pop by part of the Retail Council of Canada's annual store conference and snag some interviews with people speaking there for you. So let's just get right to it. Here's my interview with Jeff Toyster.
Hi, I'm Jeff Toyster. I'm an author, consultant, and trainer, and my specialty is helping customer service teams unlock their hidden potential. So the big focus areas for me are on culture, on frontline customer service skills, what we would think of as employee training, and also looking at voice of customer feedback to figure out what can we do better.
And Jeff, you've just written a new book, and this is your second book?
It is.
So tell us about the two books briefly.
The book that's just coming out now is called The Service Culture Handbook. And I really wrote that to be a step-by-step guide that customer service leaders can use to develop customer-focused cultures. And what I mean by that is the kind of culture where all of our employees just seem absolutely obsessed with service. They know how to do the right thing. They're fully committed. They go the extra mile. And when we see companies like that, we tend to envy them and say, how do they do that? So this book uncovers the secrets of companies who have been able to achieve that. My first book, Service Failure, was all about hidden, counterintuitive and unusual obstacles that got in the way of frontline employees who were trying to provide service. And what was fun about that is, as a customer, we've all had bad service, and we often will say, oh, what they should have done was this. It was so obvious. And so that book addresses why it didn't happen.
Right. Interesting. Well, and I think you made the point in the second book, and it's a point that I've made as well, which is most people in customer service roles, they actually want the customers to be happy. Like, they want to help them. And they're often prevented from doing that through company policies, either intentionally or unintentionally.
They do. I'm sure there's a few people who go to work and say, I want to make my customers miserable today, but you're right. Most people want to do a good job and feel like they've accomplished something.
Yeah, exactly. So, Jeff, one thing that I did really like about your new book is that I think you really accomplished your goal of it being a handbook, that it's very practical, step-by-step guidance. Here are things you can do. I was interested, you start with, well, what I call the promise, what you've called the customer service vision. But can you talk to us briefly, what's the difference between a customer service vision and the company's overall vision?
I don't think there needs to be one. In fact, in a perfect world, the company mission statement or its vision statement would articulate what the company stands for, not only as a company, but how it intends to serve its customers. So for your listeners that you aren't quite sure what we mean by a customer service vision or a promise statement, what it really is, it's a shared definition of outstanding service that everybody understands and everybody's committed to. So again, in a perfect world, the whole organization's aligned by that, but I recognize that some people reading the book might not be the CEO, and so they can't impact that kind of change, right? But they might be a department leader or a location general manager or a team leader. So if I can't affect the entire company, I can at least create a vision for my team that's hopefully aligned with what the rest of the organization's trying to do.
Well, that brings up the really interesting question, because I think very often there are individual units that really want to offer outstanding customer service, but they don't yet have more than lip service from the senior folks in the organization. So what would you advise them to do when that's the case?
That's disheartening, isn't it? When you feel like you're kind of on an island.
Yep.
We get it. No one else does.
Right.
And so here's the sad reality of that, is that a service culture is only going to rise as high as its highest champion. And what I mean by that is if the CEO is invested, then that's as high as the culture can rise. That's great. But if the CEO is not on board and isn't fully committed, you're not going to be able to get the entire organization involved. So that's the sad reality, unfortunately. But that doesn't mean you can't do anything. When I talk to customer service leaders who are in that boat, what I suggest to them is first get your house in order. You cannot expect any other department to rise to the occasion if you are allowing their challenges to hold you back or be the excuse for you not doing the things that you can control.
Right.
And so I think that's the first thing. You got to get your house in order. Mm-hmm. The second thing is, I think you need to make a better business case. What I see is a lot of customer service leaders, they'll say, you know, I'd love to help our customers, but let's say we need more staffing. Great. What your executives hear is, I want to go spend more money. So you've got to be able to frame that in a way that executive leaders are going to understand. How will, say, adding staffing not only improve service, but how will that impact the bottom line in terms of better sales or better customer retention or, you know, whatever it is? Mm-hmm. And the third thing is, I think you need to make it emotional. The higher up you are in the organization, typically the less contact you have with customers. And customers become data points, numbers on a spreadsheet, not real people.
Yeah.
And if you can make it emotional, where you can get those executives or somebody in another department to have face-to-face interaction with a customer or listen to a customer call. One of the things when I was writing the book and researching some customer-focused companies, what they did is they would do what they call customer ride-along. So they would have people from other departments connect with customers, let's say, in a contact center. And this would give them very tangible, very emotional connections to the customer that was very different than just reading kind of a synopsis in a spreadsheet or on a report.
Yeah, absolutely. Even if you can't get them to do a ride-along, even just providing them, whether it's video excerpts or if worse comes to worse, even just words on a page that are the actual customer words can still have quite an impact. Yeah. I like the fact that you use the term cultural artifacts and talked about cultural artifacts that get in the way of offering consistently great customer service. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by that?
Sure. So to me, a cultural artifact is anything that helps describe or explain your culture. So it could be a statement or slogan like a mission, vision, values. It could be a symbol or a sign or a picture, anything that helps us explain it. The challenge that a lot of organizations have is they have too many cultural artifacts that aren't necessarily sending the same message, so it's really confusing. So an example I talked about in the book, there's a restaurant that I worked with. It's a restaurant chain, and they had a mission statement and a customer service credo and 17 required service steps and then 4 pillars of delight. And, I mean, they kind of, the list went on. And individually, they all sounded great, and then you start trying to mash them together, and they're really sounding different things. And so they had an executive retreat, and I was there to talk about culture. And so I asked the CEO and his executive team and all of their general managers, I said, just tell me which one of these is the most important. And there was silence in the room. And I have to give the CEO credit, because that's an uncomfortable moment when you realize, oh, we have not addressed this. Mm-hmm. it turned into something great where there was this wonderful discussion about what was important and how do we give a clear, simple, and aligned message to our servers on the front line and anybody else that works in our restaurants. And so they made a lot of adjustments to pare all those artifacts down. And the results were immediate because you could tell now this was important and this was not as important.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that comes back to the importance of having a vision that is very concise, clear, simple, and that then, so A, people can remember it, but B, they can use it as a filter for decision making as they go forward. You talked in the book about the importance in training of coaching and practice and reinforcement. Can you elaborate a little bit about how organizational leaders should be doing that?
Sure. So I'm lucky in that I have a background in adult learning. So I have a formal experience. And one of the things that we find with training that happens in a lot of organizations is it's not truly skill building. Mm-hmm. It's more of what I would call a themed activity. In other words, people gather and there's a bunch of activities. And at the end, did you learn anything? I don't know. We had a great time. Here's a survey. Go back to work and let's hope something good happens. That's kind of the formula, right? Mm-hmm. And so what I advise companies to do is focus instead on what are the results that you're trying to achieve. And as it relates to a customer service vision or a brand promise, we want employees to know specific steps they can take to fulfill that. So if the brand promise, for example, is one of the examples I love to give is REI, where they're really about helping their customers enjoy the outdoors. Mm-hmm. Well, depending on what my role is at REI, I need to have some specific skills and techniques that I can use to help the customers I interact with enjoy the outdoors better. And so training should be focused on delivering those skills. You only know training's done if you can see the person then utilizing those skills in a real environment. Mm-hmm. And so it's got to constantly reinforce that to make sure they're actually using them.
Well, and okay, so let's take the example of REI. Yeah. It's obvious how if you're on the sales floor and somebody's interested in climbing equipment and you know about climbing, you can talk to them and help them choose the right equipment. How would somebody like the cashier who's checking them out help them enjoy the outdoors?
So I'll give you an example, and I'm a passionate REI customer, so thanks for letting me talk more about REI. So one of the things that's amazing about REI is their return policy. And I recently bought a jacket that I thought was going to be awesome. I bought it online, and I wore it for a couple of months. I was really trying to give it a try. And it was okay, but I didn't love it. It wasn't warm enough. It just wasn't right for me. And in any other company, I would just feel bad about the purchase decision and maybe buy another brand the next time or go to a different company. But I bought it from REI. So I go into the REI store. And it's not the frontline cashier, but it's kind of a separate cashier, at least in my store. We have to do the returns. Mm-hmm. And I bring it to this person. Now, most places, a return is a transaction. Mm-hmm. And they fill out a form, they swipe a few things, they interrogate you for a moment, and then they give you, you know, your store credit or whatever it is.
Yeah.
At REI, it's, okay, let's look up your account. You're a member, so you're cool. Mm-hmm. And instead of just doing the transaction, the associate actually asked me a few questions about why I didn't like it and then said, have you tried this jacket instead? And she made some really outstanding suggestions based upon her understanding of my needs. Hmm. In fact, I bought a new jacket that day from REI plus, you know, too much other stuff because she gave me the help that I needed. And to me, it's part instinct because you care enough, but it's part training to train someone, you know, to your point, who's not on the sales floor, say, look, that return's not a transaction. I need to help this person better enjoy the outdoors. That jacket wasn't doing it. So how do we help them get to where they want to go?
And I could see even if the sale or if the returns clerk didn't have the knowledge themselves, they could then link you up with someone on the shop floor who does know it. They could
Absolutely.
Say, you know what, this didn't work for you, but so-and-so here, he really knows these jackets, so
right.
Maybe you should talk.
And then you can imagine that going even deeper and say, well, what about outside of the stores? You know, with someone in human resources, well, I need to design processes to hire those right people.
Yeah.
or in marketing. I need to have a marketing campaign like REI's opt-outside campaign where they closed everything the day after Thanksgiving, Black Friday, which is huge in the States for shopping. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, no, we're going to dedicate that day to being outside. I mean, that's not at the store level. That's at a company and executive level saying, we're committed to this.
Yeah. Yeah, that was impressive. Of course, it did get them huge amounts of free publicity, but
It did. And I'm okay with that as long as you're being authentic, right?
Yeah, and it does seem that they were. I mean, that is consistent with what they're trying to do. One of the things that struck me at first as kind of interesting is you said, you know, you're talking about the procedure for developing a customer service vision. And you said not to consult customers when you're developing a customer service vision. That seems counterintuitive. Can you talk about that?
It does, because a lot of times we would think, no, we got to get our customers involved. So the reason I don't think you need to involve customers at that stage in the game is this is about developing who you are and what you're promising to your customers. And I think the challenge is if you want to ask customers what you want, you're going to get tons and tons of input potentially, but it doesn't mean that you can deliver it. And it doesn't mean that that fits your culture or your core strengths or who you are. So I think deciding who you are is, as an organization, is an internal exercise. Mm-hmm. Now, it's not that you shut your customers out completely. The step comes later in the process. We say, okay, we have this vision. We have this promise. You know, we got to make sure that, of course, there's a market for it. But then are we delivering it? And that's when you ask your customer. And that actually gives you something more pointed to ask your customer and say, okay, are we delivering on this brand promise of ours? So I'll give you an example. One of my favorite places, again, if I'm going to be an advocate as a customer, I'm a huge fan of In-N-Out Burger, and I know they're not all over the place, but where I am in San Diego, fortunately, they are. Mm-hmm. And they have a really simple promise. It's quality, courtesy, and consistency. It's pretty darn easy to ask your customers, did I deliver that? Now, even though they're a fast food place, they do not promise you that you're going to be in and out fast. Despite the name, if I get into In-N-Out drive-thru, it's going to be 20 minutes because there's a huge line of passionate customers there. And if they ask you for feedback, you know, you might say, well, I wish it was faster. And they'd say, great, we cook everything to order. How are we going to do that? Something's got to give. And In-N-Out customers are okay with that because that's not in their vision. That's not part of what they're promising you.
Right. You can't be all things to all people.
Exactly.
What are the elements then that go into making up a good customer service vision statement?
I think a lot of companies and a lot of executives overthink this process. And you get some really wonky, like if you get a statement that it looks like somebody came up with at a marketing retreat, you just get rid of it and start all over. I think there's three things that tell you you've done a pretty good job. One is it's simple and easy to understand. You can show it to someone and they can read it and they can get the gist of what you're trying to communicate. The second thing is it's got to be customer focused. I know that almost sounds like it's without saying, but I've seen a lot of visions and missions that are, you know, lead the industry or be profitable or have a good process. And I get, that's good, but that's not going to excite people to go to work every day and say, this is my purpose. Yeah. So it's got to be customer focused. And the third thing is it's got to be anchored in both the present and the future. And so what I mean by that is if it's purely aspirational and it's not really something we're doing now, then it's not an authentic representation of your culture. So the way I like to look at that last piece is, you know, what is your organization like on its best day? And that's the vision. That's what we're trying to be, just a lot more consistently. And so ideally, if you craft a really good vision, you can take it to anybody in the company and say, you know, here's what we came up with. And if you did your job right, they're going to read it and say, yes, that's us. That's who we are.
Mm-hmm. So I'm just trying to think of an example. So let's say you've got a big bank. Now, in big banks, there are going to be lots of bureaucracy and rules and stuff. So I'm just trying to think about how would they craft a vision statement that is both rooted in how they are. Let's say that they're trying to get better at their customer service. So both rooted in how they are, but also aspirational. I know I'm catching you with no warning here, but how, can you just sort of think through how that might be reflected in a...
Sure. Well, so what I like to do when I help my clients with this is a really simple survey. And what I mean by simple is one question. The survey question is, when our customers think of the service we provide, what do you want them to think of?
Okay.
You can do that survey with a small team. You can do that survey with a huge organization. And there's ways that you can then take that unstructured data and pull out the themes. So what I like to do is just use it's a word cloud.
Yeah.
And if your listeners aren't familiar with it, it's a graphical representation of the different words. And so if let's say friendliness, as an example, is in there, and tons of people wrote friendliness, then that word is going to be depicted in this visual as this huge, huge word. And then if people said, you know, procedure a couple of times, but not many people wrote that, then that word's going to be really, really tiny.
Mm-hmm.
So that immediately tells you what themes people are thinking of. And then what I like to do is I like to gather a group of 7 to 10 people. And through trial and error, I found that that's kind of the best group.
Okay.
And representative. So if it was a bank, you'd have some people who would be, you know, on the front lines in your branches. You'd have people maybe representing a couple of different departments, different stakeholders at different levels of the organization, a senior leader perhaps, and so because you want people to be well represented. And then taking that feedback from everyone, you have that group of 7 to 10 people try to come up with a statement. So it's hard to know what the bank statement would be without knowing the specific bank, because some banks will say, you know what, our goal is to be the most convenient bank possible. We're not going to have great interest rates, but we're going to be open weird hours and in branches that are convenient to you. And then other banks are going to say, you know what, we're all about maximizing your dollar and your investment. So we're going to be a little harder to find, but we're paying great interest rates and our loan terms are phenomenal. And So every bank's going to be a little bit different, right? And so that process kind of captures very simply, without overthinking it, who you really are.
Mm-hmm. So what do you do when you're doing a process like that and you find huge discrepancies so that, you know, certain parts of the organization see things very differently from other parts of the organization? How do you work on developing some kind of common vision?
So I wish I could speak to experience on that one, but I really can't. And the reason is, if we're going through this exercise, we probably already have a lot of those common frameworks in place already.
Okay.
And the organization was where that didn't exist, we didn't do it for the whole organization.
Right.
I would work with, say, a particular team or a particular department.
Mm-hmm.
Because if everybody is disjointed and sees things differently, you know, what the vision is, it really isn't inventing kind of a new philosophy. It's articulating an existing philosophy in a very clear manner. And if we already don't have that, you know, and marketing's kind of got its own agenda and operations has its own agenda and finance is thinking something completely differently. And I don't think a sentence is going to tie all that together.
Right.
So I think we probably need some more fundamental work to say, what are we really about as a company? And so maybe that's where the executive team needs to spend a little bit more time together deciding that. And I'll give you one quick example. I didn't create this vision. I came into this a little bit later. Actually, it's not a bank, but it's a credit union, so it's close.
Mm-hmm.
So I was hired to kind of assess how well did they implement it and what were the next steps. And so I did a little survey of the executives, branch managers, and frontline folks. And I think about 300 people total I was able to get data points from. And what was phenomenally, I think, fascinating to me is that everybody could kind of, it was a set of 5 core values, and that's how they defined it. 95% of the organization at all levels could say, here are the core values. You give them a blank piece of paper, they'd write them down for you. So that, hey, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
And then you ask them, okay, what do they mean? And at the executive level, so we're talking about the CEO, the CFO, the vice president of branch operations, et cetera. Nobody agreed. They had, like, one of the words was integrity. Integrity is like, no one's going to argue. Like, no, I don't think integrity is good. So integrity, everyone's like, yeah, that's a great word. Okay, what does it mean? And the CFO was like, you don't steal. Okay, I guess that's good. And then the vice president of branch operations like, you know, we do for our members what we say we're going to do. And I'm like, okay, that's pretty good. And then like the marketing chief marketing officer is like, we have an authentic brand, and they all make sense, but they don't really reconcile. And so as an organization, if your pieces are completely disjointed, then I'm sad to say a simple sentence is not going to save you.
Correct, for sure.
I wish.
Yeah, exactly. So that kind of brings me to my next comment, which is, you know, I found when I was researching PeopleShock, it's almost impossible to find examples of companies that have really managed a cultural turnaround in a big way. I mean, the companies that deliver great customer experience that we talk about all the time, you know, the Disneys, the Nordstroms, they all started with that built into their DNA. Is there hope for companies that don't have a customer service focused culture to actually develop one, really?
So I think every book's got an Achilles heel, and here's the Achilles heel from mine. I think if you're a huge organization, if you are able to execute this turnaround and make it at least somewhat permanent, you're probably going to be a very, very unusual example. I actually had an entire chapter on this topic planned, and I cut it because small organizations, yes, because you're still growing, you're still scaling. But when you get to a huge organization, you know, I looked for a few that had these turnarounds, and some of them, a number of years ago, Sprint was considered to be, you know, amongst the worst companies in terms of customer service.
Yeah.
And then they started this turnaround process, and it was really looking good for about 4 or 5 years. Their ratings in the American Customer Satisfaction Index started going up. You're thinking, here's the story. And then they hit a wall and started sliding backwards again. Mm. And they're not terrible now, but I don't think anyone would say that they are the gold standard for service either.
So what happened? Why did they hit that wall?
So, you know, a number of things happen. I think scale is one of them. You get to a certain scale, and if it's not, you know, as you point out, you know, these other companies that started in their DNA, if it's not your DNA, it becomes difficult. I think there's a certain distraction that happens in large companies, particularly publicly traded ones. All of a sudden, Sprint was dealing with, you know, are we going to buy another company? Are we going to get bought? We've had outside investors. All of those are huge distractions. They're also in a fundamentally changing industry in terms of the technology that underpins your business.
Yeah.
You know, cellular phone technology is changing rapidly.
Yeah.
And even if you have great customer service, I'd love to say that that's the only thing you need in business. But no, you need a product that your customers want. And that's another challenge too, and I think it's easy to discount all of that, but it's so complex that I think it was a struggle to say we're going to maintain the service focus while we're doing all these other things.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's interesting. It is kind of sad though too, because it means, is there really hope? I mean, it's not sad if you're an entrepreneur, because it means you've got lots of opportunities. Exactly.
Well, and here's what happens to, I mean, I've seen many, many more projects get derailed than become successful. And so even in small organizations, I think the fundamental mistake is you'll hear executives say, well, we're going to work on service this year. Like, oh, no, you're not, actually. Because service has got to be a way of doing business. And as soon as it becomes a side project, then that's exactly what it is. I mean, I worked with one organization. It's a much smaller organization than Sprint. But, you know, they started with the usual things that you'd like to hear. We're committed. This is going to be how we're going to do things. And then the CEO almost immediately started stepping out of the picture and delegating it, you know, not just down one level, but down two levels.
Hmm.
So the picture was already kind of being painted. You know, after just a few weeks into this initiative, that it's not really that important.
Mm.
And we've got other things going on that are more important versus this is how we're going to guide our way of doing business from here on out.
And,
you know, it's tough to sustain anything if you don't have that complete and total commitment.
Yeah. Well, and the other point that you make in the book is the importance of repetition, of keeping the message going, of communicating it over and over again in different, and I liked your comment, you know, using both variety and frequency, you know, that you find different ways to keep getting that message in front of people so that they are aware of it at all times and it does get built into the DNA. I think that was a really good point. We've reached our half hour mark here, Jeff. Mm-hmm. So is there something or anything that you wish I had asked you that I have not?
So I must confess, listening to your podcasts, I attempted to anticipate this question. This is a trademark of yours.
It is.
And so the thing I thought I would add, but then you kind of asked it in the last, is why aren't there more organizations doing this?
Yeah.
Why don't more organizations have a customer-focused culture? And I know we were talking specifically about big ones, but I think to kind of come back to that, my guess is my hope when people read the book, there's not going to be a ton of things in the book that you'll say, ah, I've never heard of this concept before. It's brand new. Here's the magic pixie dust we've been missing. I don't think many people have that experience. I think it'll be, hopefully, this makes sense. This aligns with my thinking. And here's some new ideas to help me out. Mm-hmm. But I think the reason why we don't see more organizations doing this is it's deceptively simple. In other words, I wrote this book to be a recipe, not something you can pick and choose. And we're going to do three out of the 10 concepts. Mm-hmm. It's a step-by-step recipe. And just like if you were going to bake a cake, that you leave out half the ingredients and only fulfill half the steps, you shouldn't expect the cake at the end of the process.
Yeah.
This is the same way. And I think that's where most organizations struggle with this, is they don't follow the recipe.
Yeah.
They're not fully committed. And the few that are the ones that get the great results.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's a great way to end this conversation, I think, Jeff. Thank you so much for your time and good luck with the book.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. All right. We'll call that a wrap. Thank you. I did quite enjoy the book. I like that it is very step-by-step. I think it's kind of a good companion piece with Gene Bliss's Chief Customer Officer. It's also very step-by-step. You know, here's how to do it. So I hope a lot of people pick it up. One of the points that I thought was kind of interesting in there was that getting employees able to parrot your customer vision statement really doesn't have anything to do with whether or not they even have a shared understanding of what the words in it mean. So if you have a vision statement within your organization, just out of curiosity, try doing some random chats with people in the organization and find out what it means to them. If you're getting a lot of discrepancy or a lot of fuzziness, maybe it's time to tackle that again. I talk a bit in People Shock about the importance of getting your vision or mission statement, or as I call it in the book, the promise, clear, concise, and shared by all. So something to think about. Other than that, just want to wrap up also with a quick reminder that I will be speaking at Customer Experience Week Canada, which takes place August 21st to 24th in Toronto. And as one of my listeners, you are eligible for a 20% discount if you use the discount code 2017CXC_speaker. So give that a go. I'm also determined that I'm going to turn the Frank Ideas newsletter back into something that's more than just a summary of what's going on the podcast and the occasional blog post. So you might want to head over to frankreactions.com and sign up for the Frank Ideas newsletter. As always, I love to get your feedback. Please reach out to me at any time, Tema, T-E-M as in marketing, A, at frankreactions.com. On Twitter, simply at Tema Frank, on LinkedIn, or on the Frank Reactions Facebook page. Have a wonderful week, and I will talk to you, actually, I guess, in 2 weeks. Bye.